Good morning. You're listening to WTUL New Orleans 91.5 FM. This is your News and Views program. I'm Kezia here with Gahiji. We are excited to have Peter McCoy and Willoughby Arevalo from the Radical Mycology Collective here in town on a national tour. International? Is Canada included?
Yeah.
Yeah, international North American tour across the country, spreading the word about mushrooms. So we're excited to have you guys in the midst of everything else that's going on. It's a nice little break.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I guess just to start off, my question would be, what makes your collective, how do you radicalize the mushrooms? What does it mean to be radical mushroom?
Well, there's a few layers to that meaning. One is that, well, typically fungi in general have been sort of relegated to the periphery of, you know, schooling and biology, and kids don't learn about them at all in school.
They're like the other.
Yeah, yeah, they're like the thing we don't talk about.
In biology.
So, yeah. And so we, for one, try to, like, just address that and try to, like, radically shift people's awareness around fungi, because we feel like they're really important in so many ways, and they are really important for ecologies, but also ways that we can work with them as humans, for, like, food and medicine, as an example. So trying to make a shift there. Also, we're kind of on the radical extreme edge of the world of mycology. Mycology has been traditionally steeped in kind of mostly just focusing on the biology, ecology, taxonomy, like
identification. And can I eat it?
Yeah, taxonomy and eating the mushroom. Whereas we're much more about less focusing on fungi for the individual, but more about fungi for the whole community or for the ecosystem. Sort of pushing that, like, understanding and interaction and consideration of the fungi.
And following their lead in multi-species community building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then kind of a part of that, taking sort of a, and then one of the bigger things about our work that separates us from a lot of other facets of mycology is we intentionally and openly integrate a very, outspoken, I guess, social and political analysis into our work. And we see that mycology really fits into a lot of global issues, like contemporary cultural issues, all kinds of issues. You know, really, it's from food to medicine to pollution to water to
economics.
A lot of different things can be, mycology can, if not directly address, help address. And to take this, like, huge skill set out of that, like, context that we find ourselves in is kind of just doing ourselves and the fungi and everybody a disservice, because it's really a valuable tool and form of understanding that can help address a lot of these things.
Also, I feel like within a newer wave of mycology that's focused on using, like, working with fungi to address these planetary issues, whether it's ecological or economical or justice or whatever, I think a lot of people have taken a kind of silver bullet approach, like fungi are going to save the planet kind of stuff. And we don't believe that they alone are going to do that. We see them as an integral part of ecology and of systems working together, and not just like this one thing that's going to all by itself fix the world's problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we just kind of, in a lot of different ways, sort of push the boundaries of people's thinking around mycology, hopefully for the better, in a way that destigmatizes them, normalizes them, takes them, and for some people takes them off the pedestal if they're really into mycology. Often that can kind of happen where mycology is really relegated because, as we'll hopefully get into, you know, it's pretty fascinating, but you kind of can lose track of everything else going on. And so kind of putting it all into an actual context.
Right. So just to begin to mention, if people are interested in learning more, there's going to be an event tonight, but we'll get to that later. But first, I'm curious how you got interested in mushrooms and came to treasure them so much.
I started seeing mushrooms, like really seeing them, when I was about 5 years old. I grew up in a small town in Northern California with the community forest right up against my backyard, and I would always go walking and see them all the time. But when I was about five, my dad had a roommate who was a mycology student at the university, and he was, you know, always bringing mushrooms home and identifying them. He was taking a mushroom identification class. So I started, like, getting interested in, you know, how little kids, like, can be really good at knowing dinosaur names. Well, I kind of, like, jumped ship from the dinosaur parade and got onto the mushroom party. And I never left it. And since then, it's just gotten deeper and deeper. I've been studying through books and through mentors and through school all my life. And then in 2012, I went to the Radical Mycology Convergence, which Peter helped organize. And I really felt like I found my community in this, and was no longer just an isolated individual in this passion, but really like connecting with other people about this. Also, there's another Radical Mycology Convergence coming up. We can talk more about that later, too.
Yeah, and I got interested when I was a teenager and just kind of got turned on, you know, honestly, with psychedelics being in my reality as a teenager, that piqued my interest. And from there, just kind of started reading about them and didn't know anybody that knew anything about them whatsoever. I didn't even know there were, like, societies, like, you know, organized public groups where you could go study this together. Like, I had no idea. And so I just read books for many years and just was self-taught, tried to cultivate here and there. It was kind of difficult by myself. It was actually really difficult. And then when I got to college, when I was about 21, I met a friend. Her name's Maya. And not only was she also really into mycology, she was kind of the first person I met that was into it like I was. We were both really involved in a lot of social and economic justice, like volunteer work and community organizing work. And we would just have discussions about how we thought mycology played into all these things that we did, but nobody had ever really said that before to us. But we really felt it, and we have a lot of kind of thoughts. And then, and then from there, a couple years later, I wrote a pamphlet or a zine called Radical Mycology. And that's kind of where the project took off. Kind of long story short, it's kind of built from there. A couple years later, we held the first Radical Mycology Convergence, and that was actually one of the really big turning points, because even then, like when I wrote the zine, I didn't think anybody would read it. I really didn't know anybody, and it was kind of written with this kind of political analysis in there with mushrooms, and it's like, who's going to get this? Nobody's going to care. But it actually was quite popular, and I sold a lot of them. I was really surprised. And so a couple years later, we decided to try to do an event and try to like teach some of the skills that we had, like mushrooms in this context, mostly focusing on low-tech, low-cost mushroom cultivation. Mushroom cultivation has historically been really difficult, but ultimately with the aim of trying to use them to clean up pollution, which they're pretty good at. And then at the first event, it was kind of really apparent to me that there weren't a lot of people that knew this stuff, that were teaching this stuff, let alone practicing it. And that was definitely a big fuel for my fire. And I think a lot of people that came to that first one to push themselves to be better teachers and to make the stuff even more and more open source.
And at the same time, like mycology is booming. It's mushrooming in like popular culture right now. There's a lot of people starting to hear about these concepts like mycoremediation, the use of fungi to eat toxins in soil and water, and other similar myco-renewal practices. And people are starting to cultivate mushrooms on their own a bit more than had been in previous decades since, you know, a long time ago. And so there's, you know, there's TED Talks happening. There's lots of YouTube videos. There's some very popular books out there. And people are starting to think about mushrooms a lot more than they had in several generations, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Did you... Well, I guess I would like you to talk about more kind of what you were saying of how it ties into the broader issues in the world, and also what you feel like is a misconception that people have about mushrooms.
Wow, so many. I think one of the biggest ones is just they're so incredibly undervalued for their role and importance in all ecological systems. They're really at the beginning, at the end of, and at the end of all life cycles as being the great decomposers, really recycling nutrients. That's super important, breaking down, you know, everything that we see pretty much, and making it available for new life. Those are the decomposing fungi. There's other fungi that channel nutrients between kind of almost all the plants in the forest, it seems. So they're really managing the forest. They make the baby trees able to survive until they're able to reach the canopy by channeling nutrients and sugars to them, because they can't photosynthesize when they're really small. So that's just one example among many of these incredible roles that the fungi do to literally steward the planet. So that's pretty incredible. They do a lot to protect the plants and to help the plants. It's pretty much on all levels. Plants and fungi have deep symbiotic relationships that are really still being just beginning to be understood. But that relationship goes back to the first plant fossils on land. There was a fungal symbiosis, and since then they've evolved completely interdependent. They're kind of almost one and the same, really. And so just like that awareness of what fungi are to begin with. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to jump on some of that stuff.
Almost all plants have fungi living within them, mm-hmm. or connected to them by their roots, doing these symbioses. And fungi in the kingdom, it's a super diverse kingdom of life, from like microscopic single-celled organisms to giant mushroom-forming sexual fungi, asexual fungi, single-celled, multi-celled, symbionts, parasites, decomposers. But the rule within, the general rule within this kingdom is symbiosis when possible. And so we can look at that as a way of as a model for building community. And because the way that they engage with so many different species in so many different realms of life, it's really a way that we can look past humanity, not ignoring humanity, but starting from humanity and working outwards in engaging collaboratively with many or all forms of life.
And one of the other things too is just, so that's like kind of their ecological value, but then our sort of more personal human value and the importance of fungi there. You know, maybe we'll get into it a little bit more, but sort of shortly put, they're basically considered a superfood. They're incredibly powerful, protein-rich, nutrient, vitamin, mineral-rich foods that can be grown off of agricultural and urban waste products. Pretty much anybody, you know, could be growing them in their closet in their apartment. It's a dense protein source, which is great for urban environments where it's hard to get fresh protein. Yeah, especially like in food deserts and stuff like that, in some of the bigger cities where it's like really hard to go get fresh food.
But there's cardboard all over the place.
Right.
And maybe coffee grounds in giant quantities.
Which you can grow the mushrooms off of.
It's true.
And at the same time, the same edible mushrooms are potent medicines, boosting your immune system, reducing a lot of types of cancer, let alone many other physiological effects, fighting viruses, all the big name viruses.
So when living in a toxic environment such as a city or even out in the country, mm-hmm. You know, they can be quite helpful to our internal ecology, mm-hmm. like our health system within our bodies.
And then we can work with them too, cultivate them and put them into the land to rebuild healthy soil, to, like we've said, break down pollutants, clean the water, many different things there to not only benefit ourselves, but again, you know, the greater world around us.
And they've evolved to have these abilities to break down complex chemicals such as lignin and cellulose, the building blocks of wood, like the tough, hard to break down materials in wood. They're the best things at it. And turns out that a lot of common pollutants are having very similar chemical structures as those substances that they've evolved millions of years ago to break down. And fossil fuels, petroleum, is basically old wood from millions of years ago. And so that's why they're able to break down diesel in a land-based diesel spill or motor oil or crude oil or any of those kinds of things.
Is this becoming more practiced to use fungi as these ameliorates to clean up the environment?
It
or
is.
Are they still, or is it still like a lot more is needed to push for?
Yes and yes. There's a lot of talk and not a lot of walk. And we're working on trying to shift that. There's a lot of science that still needs to be done, a lot of hard science, and also a lot of citizen science, like people just taking it into their own hands and learning by doing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who have read about it, a lot of people who've talked about it or seen a video about it, not a lot of people who've actually done it.
And beyond that, I mean, not only do the individuals not have the personal experience and kind of what comes along with that is the deep understanding of kind of what the fungi are, what they do, what you're actually doing when you're trying to like work with them to clean up pollution. It's kind of like this, you know, the more you work with something, the more you understand it. But beyond that, just in the general public understanding, there haven't been enough real world experiments even, or even just applications of these technologies or these techniques. A lot of the understanding that fungi can break down this chemical or that chemical comes out of a lab where they just do a little tabletop experiment. It works, they write a paper about it, but that doesn't necessarily translate to, you know, the natural world. And so one of the big underlying things with the Radical Mycology Project and where we really started, as I said earlier, was trying to heavily encourage the citizen science thing and trying to just tell people, this is kind of where you start from. This is like the basic concepts of how to cultivate fungi, what they're doing when they break down the chemicals. But now it's up to all of us to experiment and try it in our own backyards where there's pollution everywhere, trying to figure out how to adapt these techniques to make them really functional and try to figure out best practices. And it's only going to come, in my opinion, through a collaborative effort, through a really grassroots effort to develop the skills of mycoremediation, but also bioremediation in general, which includes bacteria and plants, because they all play a role.
And animals, too.
Yeah, and insects, and they all play a role in decomposition. Fungi are the great decomposers. They do most of it, but, you know, it's how does it all work together?
They don't do it on their own.
Yeah, and so just a lot, it's a huge Pandora's box. You know, it's really promising, really exciting, and that gets to the point where people kind of, when you learn about this stuff, you kind of glorify it. You know, I was there too many years ago where you're like, wow, they can do everything. But then you start to realize the reality of it, and you realize that, you know, it's not as, you know, there's not a strong of a foundation as you kind of want it there to be. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're trying to do, is trying to build a foundation to build upon in a real world context, working with everything and recognizing the limitations of the fungi. They can't just solve all of our problems. We have to do a lot too.
So yeah. And I want to just recognize that, you know, there are right ways and wrong ways to do these practices. And, you know, dealing with really toxic chemicals, for example, there's kind of high stakes there. And you don't want to spread the pollutants around. You don't want to get yourself overly exposed to them. And so there are protocols, and we're working on trying to develop those protocols to, and you know, not just the small group of us, but like as a broader network. And we feel like that's really important to happen because, for example, there was a big mine tailings pond spilled into a lake and is actually still spilling into a lake in British Columbia right now, the Mount Polley mine. And our friend Lila Darwish, who's a member of our broader network and a collaborator with us. She does a lot of grassroots bioremediation stuff, using fungi, plants, animals, bacteria, etc., on a grassroots level to deal with this stuff. And she just went up and visited it, and she's been engaged in the dialogue surrounding it. And she says, like, there's people talking about getting a helicopter and bombing this lake with mushrooms and and hemp. And it's, like, actually really ridiculous, and that's actually not a good idea.
Well, and not only will it not work, you're providing false hope to these people who've had their lives shattered by having their, you know, sacred waters polluted, and their whole way of life is going to be changed probably forever. And so to just come in and proclaim that you're going to solve it by sprinkling a bunch of oyster mushrooms on top of this gigantic lake is crazy, like bad science, but also just like horrible, you know, consideration for the human element. You know, there's a lot of ethics that come into doing bioremediation, because often there's a lot of the frontline communities that are dealing with this are often in the minority. Often minority groups,
indigenous people.
Yeah, especially in Canada. I mean, even in the U.S. too, you know, some of the most polluted and toxic land is where the Native American reservations are. And so
much mining happens on reservations. Mm-hmm. That's totally unfair and wrong, but that's how it's been.
Yeah, and so, I mean, again, we just, you know, draw awareness to that reality, and how do we go into all these practices with the most respect, in a way that empowers and supports the people that are affected as much as possible, you know, coming in as outsiders, many of us sort of from a more privileged background. How do we recognize that and just share the skills we have, the passion that we have with people that, you know, are coming from a very different background, but hopefully we can meet them in the middle and try to help them out as we share what we have to offer.
We don't want to perpetuate the colonization dynamic. And that's a funny thing, like in traditional mycological language, the word colonization has been used to describe the process of the mycelium, the body of the fungus, growing through its substrate, whatever it's growing through. And so in mycological literature, and even like amongst people doing mycoremediation work, the word colonization comes up all the time, and it's used like it's a good thing. So we're trying to decolonize the practices and our own language and our own mentalities, like by being conscious of how we use our words.
Mm. Have you consulted like your friend on one of these lakes? Have you been up to an area like that where there's been environmental pollution and so to go and kind of see maybe how fungi could possibly be an answer to this problem? Is my question clear?
Yeah, well, I mean, Lila was just at this lake. We didn't go there specifically, but, you know, I've seen personally some ecological disaster based on human pollution. And some of it has been addressed in this way, yeah.
A project that I'm involved with is called the Amazon Myco Renewal Project, and it's gone on for about 7 years. It's based out of the like Amazon Basin in Ecuador, where there's over 1,000 toxic oil pits from over 40 years of oil mining from Chevron Texaco. And kind of long story short, they've gotten away with just leaving these huge, massive, unlined oil pits that get into the groundwater, affecting all the vegetation. Everybody's getting cancer. It's really sad, let alone the environment, you know, to begin with. And so what the group has been doing, what the project's been doing for all these years, is trying to work with fungi. Initially, it started just focusing solely on fungi to clean up a lot of this pollution, figure out how to use local native fungi from Ecuador to eat this pollution. Mushrooms we find growing out of the pollution, we figure it must be able to eat it. And culturing them and growing them and trying to develop systems for them to break down all this oil. And I went down there in April, and we're developing a new system that now integrates bacteria and plants as well. Again, trying to think whole systems. But yeah, a big part of that is just trying to work with the fungi. It's daunting. It's huge. That's really one of the only like I was saying earlier, the only real world application of some of these concepts is this project.
Then that's the largest land-based oil spill in the world.
Yeah. And it's the most biodiverse country in the world. And so it's pretty crucial.
And the area is full of indigenous communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's again, but it's a big Pandora's box. And we're just, when I was down there, I was helping design with a team of people, a good kind of pollution cleanup system. But there's just so many variables, so many potential ways we can do it, so many unknowns. And it's kind of in the beginning stages of an 18-month study, trying to just test all these different designs. And hopefully at the end, we'll come up with a design that is, you know, if not 100% effective, it's the best that we were able to come up with. Mm-hmm. And we want to make that open source for people around the world to hopefully start to try to implement and maybe improve upon in the future.
And for another example, smaller example, but of significant size also, by the Klamath River in my home region in Northern California. The Klamath River has historically been a really, really crucial salmon habitat and also the basis of several native communities, as well as like settler fisher communities as well. And just amazing ecology around there. There is a big-ish slow oil, motor oil and diesel spill from a generator and a diesel tank behind what used to be a fire hall and is now a community center, right next to the river at the confluence of two branches of it, and a decent ways upstream from the ocean and in this crucial habitat. And so I worked with another group, a local group called Fungaya Farms, that was doing a micro-remediation project with oyster mushroom mycelium grown on burlap to eat that diesel and motor oil in the soil. And the project started about 2 years ago, and test results have just come back that those 90 yards of contaminated soil that we excavated from the site and installed into it, basically a giant lasagna made of myceliated burlap, straw, and contaminated soil. The test results just came back and they're quite positive. Mm. And it doesn't mean the soil is completely perfect anymore, but it's a heck of a lot better than it was 2 years ago.
So, you know, in the world today, we hear a lot about the environment being damaged. And I'm just curious, like, what kind of effects mushrooms are experiencing from the degradation of the environment more generally, or if they're doing okay, like, what their status is, or if that's known?
It's so unknown. There's so many species. I think there's, what, like, 10,000 species of mushroom-forming fungi that have been described or like known to the world of taxonomy, and that's estimated to be what, like a tenth of what there actually is.
Well, the estimates of how many fungal species are on the world range from 1.5 million is sort of the more commonly accepted, up to potentially 10 million, and you compare that to 300,000 plants and like a million insects. So I mean, fungi dominate.
In diversity
and just in number. And but also, I mean, they really rule the planet. They really do, subtly and silently. But that's kind of a different question. Their numbers are unknown, how they're being affected by species loss, destroying the Amazon jungle, you know. How many species are we losing of plants and animals in that process, let alone all the fungi? And definitely, as climate change kind of comes in the question, one of the big concepts there is the soil fungi. As soil temperatures change, some of these fungi, that'll change the chemistry of the soil, the pH, which changes kind of how the whole soil web works, and the fungi are a huge part of that. And there's definitely been studies I've seen where as soil temperature and pH changes, fungal ecologies shift or die off. And, you know, that affects the plants that rely on those fungi. And all the, you know, so it all goes up and it's all interconnected.
species are definitely moving around the planet. You know, new species are showing up in places they've never been before that we've known about, and species are ceasing to exist in certain areas. Definitely, climate change is having profound effects on those fungal communities, and then that effect ripples outward into plant, animal, bacterial, etc. communities.
So you said mushroom-forming fungi, right?
Yeah.
So what then is the mushroom? Is the mushroom like the flower? Is it itself? So now I'm like curious more about the structure of like the mushroom and what's underneath the mushroom.
Yeah.
So totally. Could That's you a great please?
Question. Thank you. All right. So the mushroom. I like to think of it as the temple of sex, Ooh. Of the mycelium. Yeah. There's the mycelium is a mass of thread-like branching filaments called mycelium as a mass, and the individual filaments are called hyphae. Mm-hmm. And
so this is like kind of a paradigm shift for most people. Is that what Willoughby is describing is really what the fungus is? Is it's this the network of threads that weaves through the soil or through the rotting thing? That's really what the fungus is. It's where it spends most of its life. It's where it does all the business of eating and, you know, interacting and defending itself. The mushroom is just the sexual function.
Ooh, yeah. Defending itself. See, now we have to talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, huge. And so a lot of medicinal mushrooms do things with our immune system, and that's because they, having a ton of surface area being made of branching filaments, they're quite exposed to the elements, and they need to have a robust immune system. And they're dealing with bacteria, they're dealing with animals that want to eat them, so they produce a lot of really interesting chemical compounds, some of which are for their immune system, and they do their digestion on the outside of their bodies. They excrete enzymes that break down the things in their surroundings and then absorb nutrients back in. The whole mycelium is very porous and giving and taking a lot. It's like,
but at the same time, it's very selective and smart in the way that it eats, if you will.
Yes.
So we ingest and then we digest in our stomachs. They digest externally and only ingest the things that are good for them. Mm. So they're kind of like a nutrient filter. They break down, you know, whether it's a chemical or whether it's wood, they break it down into simple compounds, simple sugars and amino acids, and take up those things and reassemble them inside of themselves into whatever they need it to be. They don't consume the crazy chemical and then break it down later. So it's very smart and selective of them. It's an incredible survival strategy. And that's one of the ways it defends itself, I guess. And at the same time, it's spitting out these antibiotics, antivirals, antifungal compounds, because as it absorbs the food, it doesn't want to take in competitors. So it's swimming in this chemical bath of protection so that it fights off things that want to kill it or could kill it if it got inside of its system. And also the things that want to eat its food as well. So it's fighting for its food. So it's
even two members of the same species growing in the same wood unit will form a line, like a wall between their zones to say, hey, this is my wood, I'm eating this. You can have that wood, you're eating that.
So then to go back to your question, so what the mushroom is this magical coalescence of this dispersed chaotic network of threads into a three-dimensional, highly structured figure that we call a mushroom. So it's actually, if you zoom in, that mushroom is actually comprised of the same mycelium, the same cells. The whole system is made out of essentially stem cells. It's all, you could start with one cell wherever you grab it from and it'll reproduce and eventually all form mushrooms. That's pretty incredible. But ultimately it creates this really beautiful, elegant shape and structure with smell, taste, flavor, and all these characteristics that the mycelium doesn't have, arguably simply to just produce mushrooms.
Colors, yeah. And like,
or not to produce mushrooms, but to produce spores.
To produce spores, and
to reproduce.
Spores are the reproductive gametes. So like eggs, like sperm, like pollen, like seeds. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Well, let's do a quick announcement, and then we'll return with Radical Mycology, and we'll talk about the convergence and the upcoming workshop event that's happening tonight.
Yeah.
Okay, so this public service announcement is brought to you by Habitat for Humanity and WTUL New Orleans. Habitat for Humanity is in need of volunteers to achieve the goal of making decent, affordable housing a reality in the New Orleans area. No construction experience is necessary. You can even support them through volunteer labor or a donation. More information is available by phone. Contact Cynthia White at 504-861-4121. And there is one other. Do you want New Wave or do you want the truth? The Atomic Lawn on WTUL spins a bristling, heaping selection of international punk, post-punk, and hardcore, and also features live performances and interviews by local and touring bands. The Atomic Lawn is every Friday from 10 to midnight here on WTUL New Orleans. All right, and we are back with Willoughby and Peter. Mm-hmm. Yes, got that right.
Yeah, so as you mentioned earlier, you're on a tour. So could you talk about your experience of the tour so far and what's going on tonight?
Yeah, and so the tour is kicked off basically August 14th in Telluride, Colorado. And it's going to go for about 3 months as we travel around the U.S. and into parts of Canada, going to over 40 different cities, teaching workshops on a wide range of skills and concepts related to mycology. So, so far I've done a few workshops in Telluride, Denver, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and San Antonio. One was on medicinal mushrooms, one was on the pollution cleanup aspect of fungi, one was on cultivating mushrooms in the desert, and cultivating fungi in the desert more broadly. And one was just on, you know, all these amazing things about fungi, kind of our radical mycology talk that just sort of gets into what are fungi and puts it into our, with a sort of the backing of our, some of the insights and sort of perspective that we try to bring to the table. So anyway, it's been really good. It's actually been really surprising, especially going to Santa Fe and Albuquerque, you know, where there's not a lot of mushrooms, and I didn't know what the kind of turnout would be. There's not strong, you know, it's not people's awareness. I'm from Portland. I'm from Oregon and Washington, where, you know, we live in some of the most mushroom diverse and abundant parts of the world, really. And so, you know, to me and a lot of my friends up there, it's really apparent that, yeah, mushrooms are interesting. Yeah, they're food. Cool. But in the desert, you know, I didn't know what the turnout would be. And it's actually really incredible. As Willoughby was saying earlier, people are, however it's happening through the internet or what have you, the topic is mushrooming and becoming more and more popular. And so at all the stops, we've had at least, you know, 30, 35 people, more or less. Usually the room is like pretty full. The one in Santa Fe, we had a waiting list for, which I was really surprised about, that there's that much interest in the desert to learn about this stuff. So that's pretty cool. And, you know, like in San Antonio, where they're trying to deal with cleaning up, you know, incredible pollution after decades of being a military base. People were definitely interested in the things we're bringing to the table there, because they've started to run out of options, and the government isn't cleaning it up as fast as they said they would, and things like that. So again, going back to the grassroots, taking it into our own hands thing. So that's kind of the idea behind the tour, just going to different communities, and we have a bunch of skills we can offer because we're all very knowledgeable in the subject, and trying to just bring whatever the host is most interested or thinks that their community will be the most receptive to. And so tonight in New Orleans, we're doing a workshop at the Beatnik from 5 to 9, focusing on growing mushrooms as food and medicine, touching on the integration into land projects, into your garden, touching on the concepts of using them to clean up pollution, but largely with some of the underlying aspects of tonight's talk is about how to do it in a way that's relatively cheap, simple, super effective and efficient, you know, sustainable living, if you will, especially in a kind of urban environment, what that looks like, what the reality is of how to do some of this more technical stuff in a really cramped space on not a lot of time and money. So that's the angle we're coming at tonight. And the midpoint of the tour, one of the big parts of the tour, not only to promote these skills, but also to promote an event that Willoughby mentioned, which will be kind of the midpoint of the tour, which is called the Radical Mycology Convergence, where we spend 5 days going really deep into these skills.
And where is that, and when is that?
That's going to be in northwestern Illinois, near a town called Orangeville. It's going to be on a partially wheelchair-accessible kind of homestead land in a rural area. And it's in October from the 9th to 13th. And it's a donation-based event. It's quite affordable. Three meals a day are included, as well as camping and, you know, 5 days full of workshops, presentations, hands-on projects, discussions, activities, all related to this in a broad and narrow sense. Like, we're having some fairly broad workshop topics, like, you know, chemistry and dance and cooking and how other things relate to this, but then also using that as a way to go deeper to understanding, you know, more holistically these issues and these concepts.
Great. So, yeah, I think it's worth mentioning, too, that the event tonight is also donation-based, mm-hmm. and no one will be turned away. And the Beatnik, in case people don't know, is at 1638 Clio Street, which is right near the Urban Farmstead, which was sponsoring this event tonight. So I guess I'm curious if you could give a little preview. There's anything that people have been especially excited to hear or things that surprised people the most?
Like tonight?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've kind of touched on some of the highlights, you know, then it gets more into the details from there. I think just some of the most fascinating stuff is just learning about kind of what we try to hit home a good bit too in our presentations and our workshops is a lot of pictures and stuff to really kind of set some, you know, give you the visual aspect to make these things a bit more tangible, because it is so abstract for most people that don't have a background in it. But it's really just as you learn more and more, like, it sounds like I'm just exaggerating, but it's almost everything about the fungi is fascinating. Like, all these things that they do, the ways they live, the ways that they interact, how they transform chemicals in their environment and regulate the environment. You know, just that symbiotic thing with the plants that I kind of mentioned, how they steward nutrients and channel nutrients, and all the studies that have been done around to show how intelligent that is and how incredibly profound and important that is. And then actually just the chemistry and the biology and the deep integrated symbiotic partnership that comes along with that and what that looks like. You know, it's just mind-boggling. You know, it's a giant rabbit hole. And what's really exciting about mycology, I guess this is a little teaser or something to pique people's interest, is that mycology is one of the youngest natural sciences. You know, it's really, really only in the last, really in the last 10 or 20 years that the average person can kind of get any kind of involved in it. But even more broadly speaking, it is, as a science, it's only roughly 100 years old on any real serious level. So there's just an incredible amount of unknowns. And along with ornithology and astrology, it's one of the few sciences that just the average amateur can make a huge impact in and make an incredible, profound difference and probably perhaps radically shift the understanding of fungi. And that's one of the other huge things we come at it with the radical mycology thing is just, again, supporting the citizen science thing, that there's still tons to be figured out. You know, a lot of the ways we teach cultivation comes out of not really the books, because the books that are out there are not very accessible. They mostly cater to professional audiences, lots of money, you know, professional labs, really, you know, inaccessible for most people for a lot of reasons. So we come at it with a lot of skills that you can find on the internet that have been developed by just home cultivators, a lot of them trying to grow mushrooms in their closet for illicit acts. But regardless, the same skills apply to medicinal and edible fungi. And so, and these skills that these just anonymous people on the internet share freely have radically shifted the way we understand how to cultivate fungi on, you know, pennies, fractions of a penny on the dollar of what it used to be. And so just, you know, some people come into mushroom cultivation or the concept thinking like, oh, it's really difficult, I'm just going to fail, like, it's so impossible and expensive, because that's how it's often been taught and presented forever. And that's how it's been professionally done. And it still is for some good reason. But on a home scale, for personal use, it really doesn't have to be that way. It can be incredibly easy and simple. Like any new skill, there's a learning curve. You got to get some, you know, invest $50 or whatever, buy some tools and stuff. But once you kind of get the practice down, it's pretty awesome. And there's tons of potential. And what we kind of come at it is all skill levels. There's all kinds of endpoints. You know, you can do a little, just a little couple simple things without a lot of effort, still get a good result. We teach those skills. We also teach ones that are going to take you a bit further, get you a bigger yield if you want to spend a little bit more time and money, you know, to practice. So there's lots of different ways to interact with the fungi. There's not just one linear approach. It's a very dynamic world to engage with.
Yeah, I have a couple more questions since we still got a few minutes, a couple minutes, if y'all can stay.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, you're traveling around in different places, and you were talking about Oregon and Washington, that area, and kind of the multitude of mushrooms that you'd find in that area. So that made me think about, you know, we're in a pretty moist place here, and you must see different mushrooms. So what might, like, the differences be in the mushrooms that you'll find in different areas? So, like, up there, well, maybe there might be more seawater at different areas, as opposed to here where we, you know, in this particular area, a lot more fresh water, and it's hotter and humid and all that. So what might be some of the differences in the mushrooms that you'd find in those areas? You might want to take the cap off of that first.
Oh. I'll let Willoughby answer that. He's the resident taxonomist.
And if you're able to go and see, like, some of the mushrooms in the, like, since you're traveling around, if you definitely make time to go and, like, go to different reserves and stuff to see what the...
Definitely.
Yeah, there's a particular mushroom I'm curious about. Maybe we can come see. It's like this pink one with mud on top. It awesome. Looks like a pimple.
Yeah.
In City Park.
Add on to what I just said there, too. That goes into my next question, because we are running a little bit out of time. And if possible, are there ways to easily distinct poisonous from non-poisonous? No.
There's no good rule of thumb. There's a lot of myths around that. But
okay, let's go back to the first question.
So, yeah, I mean, the whole ecologies are tied together through the fungi, and depending what tree species are present and what types of other plants, what the types of soils, as you were mentioning, what types and how much of water really play into what
climate.
What types of fungi, yeah, temperature, climate. So, you know, there's mushrooms that we see almost everywhere we go, like the turkey tail, for an example, is I've seen it in almost every temperate part of the world I've ever been in. And then there's also some species that are really specific, like they'll only grow with a certain species of tree. Mm-hmm. And traveling around, it's fun because we see familiar friends in the mushroom, fungal friends. And then we also make new ones, and we're like, hey, I found this mushroom growing out of the base of an oak tree planted in the sidewalk strip next to the freeway when we pulled off to get gas yesterday. Mm. And I was like, we were at a stoplight. I was like, Peter, meet me at the gas station. I'll meet you at the gas station. And I run out. And I'm not sure what it is, but I think it's in the same genus as reishi, which is a potent medicinal mushroom, which we both cultivate. Mm. And this is just growing out of the base of this oak tree on the side of the highway, basically. And it's beautiful.
Yeah, but as far as, I mean, I'm personally not familiar with, like, the local fungal flora and how that, you know, really compares to the stuff in the Northwest. There is a mycological society out of New Orleans that, if people listening are interested, should definitely join if they want to get introduced to mushroom identification and mushroom hunting. That's a great resource are the mycological societies. They often don't focus heavily on the cultivation aspect, and especially the remediation thing. Although I do think the New Orleans group does do some cultivation, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And it's kind of uncommon. But yeah, like Willoughby said, there are some global mushrooms that are found on almost every continent, like the turkey tail. Some are very niche. You know, and the field books that are out there, it's just like wildflowers or, you know, birds or something. Well, I mean, not birds, but, you know, wildflowers or plants. Different regions of the country, different regions of the world have specific sort of groupings. So, yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming. And for all our listeners out there, if you're curious and want to hear more about mushrooms, please come out tonight, 5 o'clock, at the Beatnik, 1638 Clio Street. And it should be an awesome time. I'm interested.
I'm very interested. It actually is in my calendar. Are you attached to the book as well?
Yeah.
So I was looking that up while we were sitting here, and I wanted to give you the chance to talk about your book just briefly as we go out.
Sure. Yeah, so earlier this year, we got fully funded through an Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign, and I'm currently working on the book Radical Mycology. So folks can go to radicalmycology.com to learn a little bit more about that. And we also have an email list there if people are interested in learning more about our events and about the conversions and things and updates on the book. It's in production right now. It's hoping to be released later this fall. And yeah. So, and it's basically going to be the punchline is a grassroots guide to the fungal kingdom, kind of all these interesting things about them, all the different ways, many of the different ways we can interact with them, big sections on cultivation, big sections on the land stewardship aspect, integrating fungi into the environment, and then all these ways to process them for food and for medicine, and then just appreciating their diversity and all these things. And for those that are out there that are interested in this, there'll definitely be a big section on psychedelics, psychedelic mushrooms, the history on that, practices, various perspectives around the world, and you know, actually bringing a pretty different perspective, I think, to the table about psychedelic mushrooms than is often presented. So. So it's going to be a really interesting book.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to see you tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah.